Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Midweek Takeaway. We're joined by Callum Summerton, CEO of Chill Brands, and Charles Archer, financial journalist and investor. Welcome back, gents.
Good to see you.
So now, Charles, you wrote an interesting blog on your website entitled The Chill Brands Edit, where you opined Chill Brands is growing exponentially and the story is just getting started. Do you want to just delve a bit deeper and explain this and maybe ask some questions of Callum on growth strategy, financial situation, and maybe talk some of the potential pitfalls surrounding regulation of vapes?
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, like to start with, go to the article because we're not going to be able to cover everything in a podcast, but the basic thing to understand is that Chill Brands has launched its Chill Zero, zero nicotine vape in August of last year. And in a few short months, you've got this vape is in nearly 2,500 retail stores, including very shortly Morrison's, petrol station forecourts, Amazon.co.uk, its own website, chill.com. So it's grown really, really, really fast. I think that the product itself, because you get so many puffs or so much usage out of the vape for the money that you pay, has a really strong economic moat, as does the fact it's zero nicotine, which, you know, I didn't really understand the concept of wanting to smoke a zero nicotine vape, but then I also don't understand the concept of zero alcohol wine or beer, and yet these things are extremely popular and growing. So, you know, you don't have to be the target market for something to realize that there's a growth strategy there. The product's good, the company's growing really fast. Oh, you're in WH Smith as well. That's the other brand name that you want to have in there. But yeah, talking about regulation, I guess that's probably, other than financing, the number one concern that somebody who's watching the company, but it isn't in yet, might be worried about. So, you know, will disposable vapes, which are like the number one product at the moment, will they get banned, for example? What are the environmental concerns? There's issues with worries about child safety against, you know, starting vaping and all these sorts of things. I think Chill's done a pretty good job of trying to protect itself. But Callum, what's your position on the regulation side?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to say is probably, and it runs directly to the regulation, the rationale for someone to buy a Chill vape or any nicotine-free vape for that matter. And that you've got sort of a few categories of consumer, but one, you've got a group that really you're bridging the gap for. They've, you know, come off of cigarettes invariably, they've worked their way through vaping, and they then have a habit, but not necessarily a substance habit. They're not necessarily focused on the nicotine. They're focused on, you know, the hand-to-mouth action, the, you know, puffing on something, the flavor is something that they sort of can't get away from, whereas they perhaps can get away from the nicotine. So we're bridging that gap for them there. Then you've also got, obviously, this huge body of people, and growing more than likely, are sort of, as with cigarettes, you know, you'd call them social smokers. Well, you've now got social vapers. And so the argument that I would make is that it is better for them to, you know, do that with a nicotine-free product that is not going to get them addictive, but it's going to give them their sort of fill of flavor and puffing on something when they're three beers deep on a Friday night, versus something that's going to get them hooked into a habit that they could stick with for life. So I think that's all relevant, you know. And, you know, before I get to the regulation side of it, one of the things we're also looking at is, I've kind of alluded before to new product development and what else we're doing with our distributors to kind of feed that market. One of the areas we're looking at now is, do we need to be with the consumer for a longer part of their journey? Do we need to help ease them through lower strengths of nicotine? And whether that comes to pass, we will find out. But yeah, that's broadly why someone would be using the product. The reason I say all of that is the person who should be using our product is an adult consumer. And so looking at the regulation generally, the big thing is that, you know, everybody legitimately in the industry can agree, nobody is out here trying, wanting to sell a product to children, at least not if they're a legitimate producer, brand, manufacturer, distributor. That being said, there is a big problem in the UK with, you know, the industry. There are an enormous number of black and grey market vapes that have flooded the market, and they are being sold under the counter to children or anybody who wants to buy them. You don't know what's in them because they are black and grey market. No one's testing them. The legal rules, you know, that the rules, it's not that they don't apply to them, it's just that no one polices them, because that is the nature of an illegal products, and that's why prohibition doesn't work. It's why we've seen since the sort of Australian rule changes on the 1st of January, looking around stores and seeing queues around the block and people just completely disregarding the ban because, you know, if a market exists, it will persist regardless of regulation. I think, you know, the two areas are pretty clear. And I think you did a really, appreciate the really good job of highlighting that you did in the piece on us, which is you've got environmental concerns and then you've got youth concerns. The environmental concerns is an area that the industry must do better on. And, you know, I've said before to Kev and Phil, you know, vapes are pretty recyclable, actually. It's just changing consumer behavior. There are still people who don't recycle their, you know, grocery packaging. They just stick it straight in food waste. And so you've got to make it really easy for customers and consumers to recycle your product. And then you've got to give them the time to get used to doing it.
Sorry, I mean, my question, okay, so if you want to, say I went to Morrison's last week and they're on the shop shelf and I buy a Chill Zero vape, how am I recycling that? Do I need to bring it back to the shop? Can it go in a green bin? How does it work? Is it something, is it like a specialist recycling thing or is it just generalist at the moment? Yeah.
Yeah, to be honest, it's a bit of both. So in certain counties, I'm in Wiltshire, and here we can do curbside recycling of vape products. You put it in a bag outside with your recycling and it'll get picked up and taken off and treated in the way that it should be treated. Enough people know about that right now. And, you know, in all of the counties where that is available, that needs to be championed and shouted about. Because if you can just, you know, deal with your product at home rather than needing to take it somewhere, that's going to increase the rate. In all of the stores that sell, you know, a certain amount of product, so all supermarkets, all pretty much all convenience stores, they will be selling over the threshold of the number of vapes that you need to sell in order to have the requirement to sort of have a recycling unit, a safe disposal unit in your store. Whether they all comply with that rule is another issue entirely, and it's something that we and our distributor partners at Phoenix to Retail and others are trying to crack at the moment. So we recently sort of said that we're going to be partaking and facilitating a recycling program that will be putting those units into stores. And the reason the industry is acting is because we've noticed that, of course, stores wanting to maintain their margins are not doing that. And so if we as an industry can facilitate it, then we must. You can take it to stores, but, you know, I think the answer really is, one, to make it more widely available, to make it very easy to do this. No one wants to be driving to the local recycling center or dump to get rid of these products. And two, we've got to look at materials. You know, we've got to make it really easy for these centers, once they've got hold of the product, to separate out the battery, to take the shell. And also, you know, we can look at materials generally. You know, we can look at biodegradable outers. We can look at, you know, all sorts of different things aside from the batteries that do and, you know, will for a long time require specialist treatment. We, you know, outside of that, we can look at lots of solutions that are more eco-friendly.
So here's a question, right? I said, okay, the UK decides to have a ban on disposable vapes. Yep. It might be good for you if it's only ones containing nicotine. In fact, it would probably be very good for you. Or that's vapes which are not recyclable, and there's a few of those. But what if it's a worst case scenario? I don't want to like start and fog after this, but they go, right, all disposable vapes are banned. I don't see that happening, but I think it is something you do need to like plan for. What's the strategy there?
Really good question. So I think that on balance, you're right. It is pretty unlikely that it'll be in you know, overly simplistic terms, just an outright blanket ban. I think that, you know, come quarter, you know, second quarter of this year, we'll probably see sort of movements towards some sort of taxation on the area, because why ban something when you can, you know, make tax revenue from it? And I think that's much more likely, and the industry will be ready to deal with that and pricing will be adjusted accordingly. But I guess that there are two scenarios. Scenario one is that it doesn't affect our devices, and that's possible on the basis that, one, they are nicotine free. And so, you know, it may be that they don't get regulated in that sense at all, because there is not a reference to nicotine free in the sort of relevant laws as it stands. And they would need to legislate further above and beyond what they're probably planning to do to bring them under the policy. Two, if you look at the wording of the government consultation that sort of came out in autumn of 2023, they were talking about defining disposables as products that are either not reusable and not refillable and not rechargeable, or both. Now, in this case, if you look at our 3000 puff product, you know, regardless of the fact that it has no nicotine, it is rechargeable. And so there's a chance there that, you know, depending on how they cut this and define it, it wouldn't be caught by that sort of regulation. However, let's look at that worst case scenario. Yeah, if we did find ourselves in a world where disposable products have been banned outright. Well, one, we expect that there will be a lead time on that. The government know that they can't just rug pull, you know, groceries' fastest growing category suddenly overnight, because retailers will, you know, lose their livelihoods in some places. So there's a lead time on that. But also, you know, sat in front of me here, and Kev's seen this in Dubai at the show, we have pod systems that are both reusable, refillable, rechargeable, and they're ready to go. The reason we haven't switched to them yet is simply consumer preference, because right now consumers prefer the ease and the simplicity of a disposable, because they can, you know, in the same way as they pick up a pack of cigarettes, walk out the store and light it up, they can, you know, get out of the store, open the packaging and start puffing. And so that's why we've not made that switch already, but we are ready to do it. And, you know, going back to new product development, there's lots more that we can do in terms of innovation in that pod category. Over time, that's where the market will go. And of course, that's where we will go as well.
That's a wonderful answer. So let's go to more positive shores. So the Chill Zero Vape was launched in August, that's right, 2023. Right. Obviously, at that time, you had zero stores. How have you grown so rapidly? Like, I am impressed by it, but it seems very fast for a product that's only been out for like 4 months. What did you do? Witchcraft?
Yeah, a bit of witchcraft. No, persistence is the big thing, obviously. And, you know, we've backed the right horses with our partners in the vaping group in Phoenix to retail. You know, we've been fortunate in that the calculated bets we made with the people we're working with have paid off. Largely, you know, there's a couple of things that have helped us along the way, though. One is that the zero nicotine end of the market has been pretty underserved. People have not focused on that because generally these are companies that are run from Shenzhen in China. They aren't, you know, on the ground in the UK. They're not focused on what people necessarily want. And they haven't necessarily noticed yet the trend that rather than going higher and higher in terms of nicotine strength, there are customers who are wanting lower and lower. And in fact, nicotine as well. So we caught the trend at a very good time. And the retailers have been recognizing that as well. So they've been, you know, jumping on with us. That's the first thing. Second thing that's similar point to that is that our product is branded specifically for this market. You know, I think that it's been pretty well picked up on that chill is a word and a brand that is, you know, relevant to a Western consumer, someone in the UK, the US, Europe. But it's also a word that is, you know, pervasive in many languages and cultures. You know, it actually has sort of crossed those borders as some words do. So our brand is designed to work here. That's not to say that other brands don't work here, but if you look at Elf Bar, Ski Crystal, Hayati, you know, some of the other products that are on the market today that are very popular, they are popular in spite of their branding because it's not relevant to a Western consumer. It isn't targeted in an effective way that actually, you know, works for them and evokes something when they look to buy it. Instead, it's been successful because it is widely available and has huge distribution. And so, you know, people have recognized that. The other thing simply is that we spent an awful lot of time, and I, in the process of doing this, got myself hooked onto to nicotine because I was trying the juices with nicotine. We spent a lot of time trialing flavors, and we knew that we had to get the flavor profile right because that is the big selling point in zero nicotine. You know, talking my own book, but I think we've nailed it, and that seems to be the consensus with the supermarkets, and that's, you know, another reason why we've managed to get that distribution piece locked down. So the final point, not to overdo it, is success in vaping. Success, you know, follows success. The more doors you open, the more people realize that, hey, we're not going to be the only ones taking the risk on a new product category. We'll pile in as well. And so, you know, it's the term I use usually is concentric circles. You know, it starts off with a little core, a nucleus of independent stores and grows outwards from there and, you know, continuing to do that.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, like, I've covered a few whiskey companies in the past, and you've got to try the product, obviously, to know. I don't vape and I don't smoke, but I do drink. And yeah, you know, after a few bottles, you tend to know whether the taste is worthwhile. But I don't know. I think it's one of these things, isn't it? Yes, you've grown really, really fast. I noticed that Jonathan Swan, who owns just over 6.5% of Chill, lent you £1 million at very good terms compared to the prevailing interest rates. What's the financial situation going forward? Obviously, you've got to sustain that growth. I mean, I said in the article, perhaps you're a victim of your own success. You've grown really, really fast, like many retail companies, perhaps faster than what you thought would happen. And now it's a question of how you sustain that financially as you go.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've sprung out of nowhere, basically. And, you know, cash is king. Cash flow is very important. We've obviously got to work out how to go from, you know, ordering just enough product to satisfy the deals that we've got to making sure that we have enough surplus in the tank, in the warehouse,
yeah,
to do, you know, side deals, because inevitably we're now growing very rapidly. That rate of growth is actually accelerating, if nothing else. And so, yeah, that, you know, cash is king is what I'd say to that. There's two sets of sort of, you know, cash to look at, two sort of categories. You've got capital expenditure, and that CapEx is things like slotting fees for stores. It's the marketing activations, and that we've got to continue to work on. We've got to resource the business effectively. I make no bones about that. You know, it has to be done because we are growing, but it should also, and is appearing to, yield very good results for us in a very short time frame. You've then got the sort of harder technical piece, which, you know, can largely be ignored by the markets in general, I think, on the basis that it doesn't, you know, make too much difference to them. It just makes a difference to how quickly I can grow in different directions. And that is cash flow. It's, you know, from the moment that you order a product for a new deal, you're then, you know, 30, 60, 90 days out of the money by the time you actually get paid on the sort of invariably 45 to 60 day payment terms that a big supermarket or the likes of them will deploy. So
I've experienced this before many times. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, cash flow is a difficult thing to manage when you're effectively a new business that is growing very rapidly. But, you know, clearly we have lots of options in front of us on that front. You know, Jonathan Swan, as I say, very commercial loan is one of those, but there's lots of other sort of, you know, alternatives and options in terms of invoice factoring and facilities of that nature that we can use. And, you know, a lot of the big brands do use that we'll be able to get into as we establish a name for ourselves and as we establish, you know, a history in business, because I couldn't have rocked up on day one launching the product and said to, you know, Close Brothers Asset Finance or somebody, hi, here's the new product. Please take a very big gamble. You know,
you'd be surprised how many people try that, though, Callum.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't. I mean, it's one of those, isn't it? I think you are growing really fast. The growth so far has been really impressive. But I guess, you know, from my own perspective as an investor, the question now is going to be, what are the reorder rates like? What's the revenue? What's the margins? Not the growth margins, the actual margin. What's the profitability? And the key thing, I think, you know, my takeaway is that because the major launches in the large brands are all in this month, January, there's going to be a few months before you have that data. And then the question is, do you buy shares now when, you know, I'd say the company is relatively cheap, but then you do have to take, as you use the word, the gamble that all the numbers are good. Can you give us any kind of data about, you know, reorder rates maybe, or is that need to be in an RNS?
Well, to avoid, you know, saying anything that I'm not allowed to say, but to give some context there, I suppose, you're right that obviously, you know, so far we've gone into the independent stores, and what they provide us with is a bank of anecdotal data, but there is inconsistency in independent stores because they are inherently inconsistent, you know, from one another. And so that's the first thing to bear in mind. We're now going into the majors, and you're right that it's going to be, you know, a few months at least until we start to see, you know, what that data looks like. I think on the margin point, you know, our margins on a pipe fill order as we first go into these big stores are, you know, at the levels they're at, but they should improve from there because you're then, you know, into reorder cycles and not paying slotting fees and activation fees and the costs of setting up an account. In terms of the reorders themselves, what I can say is, and I mentioned this in an RNS a little while back, The anecdotal and the contextual data that we have from those independent stores is encouraging. We're seeing that people reorder within sort of 6 weeks. We have made it a priority to make sure that our strategy on reorders is very good. And the way that we tackle that is important depending on the sort of channel we're going through. When you're dealing with Morrisons, when you're dealing with, you know, a supermarket or a grocer that's sort of a chain store, they are sophisticated in the way that they reorder because they know their stock levels, you know, down to the second. When you're dealing with independent stores that are run by, you know, families usually, they aren't particularly minded to, in the middle of the day, pick up a phone and, you know, place reorders in that way. So they have to be nurtured more. And that's a piece that we've started to tackle now in the new year with, you know, several months of data. What I would say is that if you look at, you know, what a good B2B reorder rate is online, I'm not going to sort of dig into that. People can look it up for themselves and draw their own conclusions. But if you look up what a good B2B reorder rate is, for the stores that we've been working with and have a good grasp of, we are within that territory. We are within that range. I certainly am encouraged enough to be able to be repeating that data you know, on a podcast now, but also in the retail meetings that we're having with larger stores. So, you know, we have what I believe to be product market fit.
Are you sure you shouldn't go into politics? That was a wonderful answer. That was extremely positive. But again, I think, yeah, it is going to be very interesting. But, you know, I think it's a great product. I guess what one of the other questions is, let's say we're a year from now, right? And all your dreams have come true and Chill Zero is in every shop in the UK, pretty much. What's stopping another company coming and stealing your pie, I guess is the question. Because I don't think like it's like the concept of a zero nicotine vape isn't patented. So I guess the question is, what I get, okay, I see, I suppose you're the market mover, you're the first mover advantage, but what are you going to do to kind of shore yourself up and protect yourself going forward?
Yeah, correct. I mean, I think first mover advantage is one of those kind of cliches. There's always someone who's done it before you. And in this case, yeah, certainly people have done it before us, but I don't think they've done it as well or at the scale that we're trying to achieve here. So I think that there's two sort of answers to that. One is, you know, continued expansion. Certainly you end up with attrition in the vaping game. You know, we saw it with Elf Bar had, you know, legal and regulatory issues. They fell off the wagon for a while. And so Ski Crystal and Gold Bar came in and took over a large portion of that market and ate their market share. The way that you know, you can't avoid competition. We want actually people to enter the zero nicotine market because it builds the category. You don't want to be the only brand somewhere unless you've got something that people have to actually survive. And so I think that we do want sort of some competition in a healthy sense. However, the way that we will continue to grow, the way that we put the company on a sort of stable footing is that we have to continue to innovate. We've got these Chill Zero vapes now, but they can't be the only product. We have to expand the range. Yes, we've got to make sure that the quality is still, you know, as we would argue, the best. The flavors are still the best. But we've got to look at, you know, the pod devices. How can we make it more convenient for people to get their sort of fix of vaping? How can we make it easier for people to quit smoking, which is, you know, still one of the leading causes of death in this country? Mm-hmm. And how can we make a use case for ourselves that, you know, steps outside of the realm of, well, you know, their vape's a little bit cheaper than ours today, so the customers are going to go for that one. So that we have to keep our fingers on the pulse of utility. And the way that we do that is by, you know, fanning out the product range and, you know, staying alive to what the next developments are going to be within this category.
Constantly jumping ahead, that's what retail is all about. I think you alluded to it, that you were talking a little bit earlier in the podcast, you are potentially considering releasing very low nicotine vapes on top of your zero nicotine vapes. Is that something that you've had like active conversations about, or was it kind of just like an idea in the background?
Yeah, it's something that we are exploring, you know, that nicotine category. It's something that we don't take lightly either. You know, I won't go into too much of it because we've got some very specific ideas and, you know, not to give the cop-out answer of, oh, I don't want the, you know, the competition to hear me. Anybody to hear me at the moment while we're formulating those. But certainly, you know, we have looked at, you know, all sorts of options, you know, one of them being obviously nicotine, not at the high strength, because in all categories, if you look at cannabis, alcohol, nicotine, companies tend to gravitate towards higher strength. They think that people want more and more and more, and that isn't always the case. And we've seen that in, you know, this company's legacy, cannabis. You know, there's a huge pushback in the moment in the US against ultra high strength because it doesn't do great things to people. The same is true here, but, you know, alongside nicotine or non-nicotine, we've also looked at other delivery sort of mechanisms. Could it be that we introduce some sort of vitamin-based additive or active ingredient? Could it be that there's caffeine? And the answer to that sort of bigger question is we need to look at the science. I don't want to be putting an active ingredient in a vaping product that is either unsafe or doesn't actually yield any result for people. We need to look at bioavailability and we need to look at, you know, what that profile is once it enters the lungs. So yeah, I guess the short answer to that is all of those options are on the table to us. We just want to make sure that we come out with the right thing for the customer, because you have to be led by what they really need and want and what's safe for them. And if we continue to kind of innovate in that direction, then I don't think we can go far wrong.
Can we pivot now to chill.com, right? Because I understand it now. It took me 5 minutes to understand what the business model is. So obviously you sell your own vapes and various other products. There's tons of other brands on there. It seems to me that you allow the brands on the website and then you just take a cut of the sales. Is that essentially how it works?
Correct. Yeah. So we'll put a brand on the website. You know, there's two options for a brand going onto the website. They can either drop ship the product, and we favor that in the early days to see how well it moves and to look at the volume. And the alternative is that they, you know, do what I'm loosely calling fulfilled by Chill, which is similar to what Amazon do. They take it into their own warehouse and they aggregate all these products, and then they can send out their very conveniently lots of different items from lots of different brands. We take a cut of whatever's sold. That cut, you know, varies depending on what kind of leverage we have on the brand. If it's an enormous, very popular brand, we'll take less, you know, maybe closer to the 20% mark. If it is a, you know, up and coming brand that we're backing because we believe that category, nootropics, adaptogens, mushrooms, what have you, will do well, but is unproven, then we'll take a bigger cut, you know, 30 to 40% plus. So that is it in a nutshell. You know, the thing with the chill.com website and the marketplace concept is, you know, it is not an overnight thing. To make that work, to make that, you know, pay for chunks of, you know, the company's operations, we need to get many more products on there. We need to attract many more users. And, you know, simply put, Chill Zero, Chill Vaping is our cash cow. It is our primary commercial focus right now. But the scalable opportunity, the one that could, you know, one day, if we get it right, be massive, is the marketplace, because it's ultra lean. It costs us very, very little to run and operate. And, you know, the upside to us is introducing customers to brands. And it's as simple as that.
Very good. Now, here's a question for you. I use the word reportedly in the article because I couldn't find an original source. And that might be my poor journalistic skills. But I never quote anything unless I can find the original. But reportedly, you've been in contact with some of the major tobacco brands about a potential buyout in the far-flung future. Is that true? I mean, I suppose you must have industry contacts regardless, but is that the long-term plan?
Well, look, I suppose take the two elements of that. Have we been in contact with various contacts from the big tobacco companies over time? Yes, absolutely. You know, it's important to stay in touch with those people because they also have an ear to the ground with regulators. You know, they are formulating the policy themselves in some cases. So yes, we have been in contact with people that we know and, you know, speak to somewhat, you know, frequently at big tobacco companies. And I won't say who or what or where. Now, we haven't spoken to them about a buyout by any means. You know, I think that is very much premature. But is it inconceivable? And again, this is really speculative, but is it inconceivable that somewhere in the future that could be a sort of a solution, a sort of end game for Chill and a result for our investors? Yeah, it's one of many different options. And of course, the thing for big tobacco in the vaping category is if you look at BAT or PMI or Altria or JTI, all of them are looking at vaping as a category and heat not burn as a category for, you know, replacing the slowly receding tobacco market globally. They need something, and this is, you know, that something.
Well, I mean, you say slowly receding. British American Tobacco, that's a BATS ticker, wrote down $31.5 billion of value in traditional categories in the US in, well, just last month. You know, it can be surprising how quickly habits change. And yes, obviously cigarettes are addictive, but, you know, these companies are spending billions and billions on new vaping and new products. And yet you're finding a market position regardless, which is really, really impressive.
It's that's the thing. It's that, look, if you look at the way that big tobacco moves into this category, so far they have had mixed success. You know, they throw a lot of money at it, as they rightly should, in developing products. They obviously, you know, attempt to, you know, be the voice of reason, the voice of sanity and safety in this product category because they've got many labs and scientists working on these sorts of products. However, it's considered by many in the industry, you know, vaping started as a hobbyist industry. You had people making their own coils and tanks and mod devices. A lot of people see this as very hollow from big tobacco. It's almost akin to sort of greenwashing. It's, well, you guys caused the problem. Why should you be part of the solution? And that, you know, resonates and echoes throughout the industry. The products that they've got are relatively sanitary as well, because they know they can't go back into the world with a sort of Joe Camel or Marlboro Man type character. And so where I see there being opportunity is in, you know, creating a brand that is safe, it's clean, it captures the zeitgeist, and it's, I'm not going to say, you know, sexy or cool, but it's a brand that actually, you know, has a bit of character to it, because that's something that, the, you know, big tobacco, when they're creating their own brands now, tends to shy away from.
Can't do it.
They can't do it. And it does seem hollow. So, you know, again, to be totally realistic, it is perfectly possible that Big Tobacco will take no interest in us whatsoever and that we'll be considered a minnow and they'll pass us by and ignore us. We're going to continue to build our brand and make it, you know, as big and as popular as we can do, you know, come what may, and regardless of their stance on it. You know, it may be, is it conceivable that at some point in the future, somebody might look to pick up a brand that has captured that zeitgeist, captured a portion of the market, and, you know, is an interesting property for a group that is clearly hot and looking at this area with a great deal of interest, then yeah, you know, that is possible and plausible. It's just not a nailed on thing, of course.
No, nothing ever is, especially in retail. But you've got the brand name and you're growing. And, you know, often, I think in the small cap world especially, because I cover small caps, but I also do a lot of my blue chip work, you kind of forget, yes, you are a minnow, but you could be bought out at a premium, you know, 5 times or 10 times, even 100 times. And the big tobacco companies wouldn't even notice the cost of the acquisition, right? So there's, you know, going for you as well. I mean, in terms of growth strategy, obviously you've got Chill Zero, and yes, you're going to get those concrete numbers out over the next few months, but you've been expanding into the US as smoker friendly. There's, you know, plans to go into Europe in time. What's the strategy? Okay, so talk a little bit about the US and also the Europe plans for 2024.
Yeah, so taking the US first, the US is a market where we're really starting to see traction. You know, it's a much more fragmented market than the UK. You know, we can send outbound sales team and pretty much dominate every geographical area of the UK in a couple of days. To do that in the US, we would need to spend enormous amounts. And, you know, again, having looked at the history of the company, tried to be very conservative in the way that we grow this whilst still seizing all the opportunities that we can. But that being said, you know, we're launching into smoker-friendly stores now. They are the largest, you know, dedicated sort of category-specific smoke store in the US. And they are noticing, you know, a trend towards this. There was a quote in RNS from Sean Musgrave, who's their sort of category manager. And he was saying, look, our customers want this sort of product, which is very heartening and very encouraging for us. We're also now seeing that other retailers have noticed that, both e-tail and physical sort of bricks and mortar retailers. And that news is now passing back down to the distributors. The distributors control the market in the US. And until they hear about a trend, they're usually a little bit behind the curve, they won't adopt it. Well, now they're definitely hearing about the trend, and we're being able to supplement that knowledge with data from the UK and sort of traction in the UK that says, look, this is not a just a sort of flash in the pan, you know, brand that we've plucked out of nowhere and it's, you know, 2 months and done. This is a growing trend. We're adding stores every day, every week, every month. And if it happens in the UK, it's likely to happen in the US as well. There is another factor in the US that is very interesting, and that is that the regulatory environment there is quite different. The FDA, which is responsible for all of this, Food and Drug Administration, for those who perhaps don't know, has been very reluctant to issue PMTAs, pre-market tobacco authorizations, effectively to any brand. There are, there's six that have been issued overall to nicotine vapes. And of those, only four are still produced. So a very large proportion of the vapes sold in the US today are sold in the gray market. And the FDA are sort of increasingly regulating that. They're starting to crack down. They're starting to say to stores, well, if we catch you selling a nicotine vape, a tobacco product that is regulated without a PMTA, which, by the way, we're not going to issue to you very readily, then, you know, we're going to find
all the actual consequences.
Yeah. Exactly. And they're starting to bring down that hammer with fines, you know, $20,000 a piece in cases for small stores, which cannot stomach that level of a penalty. And so what we do know is that a nicotine-free vape falls outside of that regime if it's disposable. People can't add their own nicotine to it. There's no way to classify that as a tobacco product because, you know, an engineer skilled in the art is the legal language, I guess, is unable to tear one of our devices down, add nicotine to it, put it back together and use it. And so one of our sort of major upcoming, in my view, selling points in the US market that will be a catalyst for expansion and growth is the fact that we have a compliant product in a market that people do want, that should be a pretty clear sell for retailers, for distributors who like to operate in this space. Vaping isn't going away, it's just changing. And that's, you know, for me, where the opportunity is. So that's the US. You know, looking to Europe, it's very much a rinse and repeat of what we've done in the UK. It's that scaling. We're looking at Spain and Germany and Belgium and the Scandinavian countries. And what we need to do is make sure that as we're growing, we are doing it in a very compliant way. We have to do it by the book. We're a PLC, but also, yeah, I want this company to have staying power. And you don't do that by, you know, entering countries on the sly and not complying with their rules. So we are, you know, compliant by design. And that's what we're working on now before we can get into those European countries. And the same is true as we look further south to the Middle East, to Egypt, to the UAE, to Oman. These are areas that are ripe for products in this sort of category. You know, these are people who are used to social smoking products, things in the sort of shisha realm. And so our target audience in the Middle East is a little bit different to the way that we position the device in the West. And so, yeah.
Sorry to interrupt you, Callum. When you expand into Europe, do you have to modify the Chill Zero vape for different countries, or does it pass muster regulations for the whole EU already?
It does pass, yeah, exactly. So the product itself does pass those regulations. There are no issues there. All of our ingredients are obviously, you know, food grade and certified for use in products of this kind in the European Union. We're very careful and cautious about that. The same is true for every country that we're in, US and UK as well. We're tailoring the products to jurisdictions, but right now, you know, the same device that's compliant here is compliant in Europe and it's compliant in the US. However, the thing to note is if you go into Germany or you go into, you know, Italy or Greece, you've got banderol and sort of various sort of tax rules that you have to pay heed to. You've got to make sure that the packaging is compliant. You've got to make sure that all of the relevant warning labels that are required in each jurisdiction are there. And so what I would say is there's a slightly different commercial model, not hugely, but there's obviously taxation in different, you know, ways and shapes and forms to consider for different countries. And there is an aesthetic piece, which is, you know, what do we write on our packaging?
How do you market it to different countries? Yeah, the different psyche of nationalities.
France is an area that we're kind of watching very closely, for example, because their regulatory kind of approach is somewhat different to the rest of Europe. However, in France, vapes are called puffs. And so, you know, you've then got to say, okay, well, is this a 1500 puff or a 3000? You know, you've got to work out.
Yeah, you've got to word it properly. I do the same. Like, I speak Italian and French, and I do marketing in both those languages. And you'd be surprised how often I'll be asked to translate an article or a piece or whatever from English to French or Italian, and it doesn't make any sense at all, you know? So, yeah. I mean, I don't know. So you're saying the product is completely compliant. The way you market it and the way you package it will have to be different from country to country.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's really a case of just making sure that when we go into these markets, we are as relevant as we are here. You know, with Chill, we're lucky because, as I say, that word sort of transcends language barriers in many cultures. But, you know, of course, I think this was the point that you made when we first spoke, Charles, on KitKat. You know, there's also opportunities and pitfalls to stumble into.
Yeah, well, okay, so... Here's a personal question. I mean, I put that article out yesterday, the day before, and I don't know whether it was an investor or just a random member of the public just posted a picture of the Chill Zero vapes at Heathrow in a cabinet. How did that make you feel? Because I tell you, like, I talk to CEOs and people who come up with products all the time, and half the time they never make it to market. I think this is one of the things that lots of people don't get. So many people coming up with ideas and then they're pitched and they get financing that just doesn't happen. How does that make you feel to go, oh, wow, our vapes are in Heathrow, the busiest airport in the world?
It's really validating, honestly. It's super exciting. And it's just, as I say, it's validating of work we've put in that, you know, since 2022, we've been working towards this. To see it in the stores, for it to be, you know, passed by and seen and purchased by people, you know, is so good. There's been a couple of occasions now, and I hope that these will become much more common, where I've been, you know, out on the street and I've seen somebody puffing away on one of the vapes that are so sort of dear to our hearts because we've worked so hard on them. And so that is, you know, it's a great feeling. You know, I think you make a good point about, you know, Heathrow being the busiest airport in the world. If you look at the fact that those vapes are in there now, having only come to market in August as a kind of new kid on the block, it's amazing. It's been a lot faster than I ever expected. And, you know, growth is exciting and scary and daunting and wonderful at the same time when it comes this fast. But, you know, it's great to see proof of concept and bringing that kind of back to the investment case, I guess. I think it's very important in retail for our investors to be able to go to somewhere relatively local to them or in the same country, stroll down the road and see a piece of the company that they own. you know, it certainly makes me feel better about it than, you know, hoping that a far-flung asset, well, exists, and most of the time they do, but also, you know, has some minerals in it or something. You know, this is
the talking wise and that, you know, let's not talk about that because that attracts all the gun and marmite investors. But yeah, no, I don't know. I mean, I guess we're going to have one last question. I think we've covered all the bases pretty much. Is there a, so we've talked about the Chill Zero, the vape, which is clearly the flagship product. But is there anything kind of in the pipeline, kind of like in the far-flung future, like a product or an idea, something that you're thinking about that like maybe investors won't have on their minds that you haven't talked about before? Or do you want to keep your cards close to your chest at the moment?
Yeah, I guess there are, as I say, with the kind of vape innovation stuff, there are things that I don't want to say just yet. And I also don't want to create a false expectation because, you know, as you say, with retail products, some of them may not come to pass. And so it's not good to get people excited about something until it's close to being real. But a few things, I guess. One is, you know, on chill.com, we obviously intend to make that much bigger and wider than it is. You know, the intention is for that to be a hub of, you know, wellness and health and supplements and alternatives for that movement of people who have decided, I don't want alcohol, but I still like to have the alcohol alternatives. I don't want nicotine, but I want those alternatives. It's a whole movement. You know, it's the same sort of people who are buying into, you know, at the one end yoga retreats, but at the other end, you know, gummies to take before they go to sleep and, you know, bespoke stays in nice Airbnbs and what have you. There's just lots of ways that we can cut that and expand. And I'm very excited about chill.com as a sort of long-term prospect. I guess, you know, looking at the company as a tobacco alternatives mainstay, one area that, you know, we are revisiting, and again, it's something that I don't know if we will pull this off or if we will focus on this because we will focus on whatever is most likely to generate value. But, you know, we came from pouches. We looked at CBD pouches, obviously, in the past. We had these synthetic nicotine pouches. You know, we are seeing in Europe now, more so than necessarily America, this rise of Zyn and Velo and oral chew pouches. It's not inconceivable, again, that we would look to re-enter that space, not with a nicotine pouch per se, but with, you know, another substance, nootropics or caffeine or something that actually will give people a bit of satisfaction in the same way that our Chill Zeros do without the addiction. So that's something that we're looking at. But for now, of course, the main thing is just growing Chill Zero, getting it out, getting it sold, and getting it in front of consumers so that they know this is a vape brand that they can choose and they should choose. So that's the focus, but there's always more that we can and will do.
Wonderful. Well, I think that wraps up pretty well. I think you've answered every question I have. And hopefully people who have been listening, you know, thousands of you, hopefully, will have, you know, a lot of those gaps filled in for the Chill investment case. I mean, I think it's really exciting. I think it's a product that is going to do really well. And the fact that you've managed to grow really quickly does signify that you've got heaps of promise. And so now I guess all we have to do is wait and see whether heaps of promise turns into, you know, concrete numbers. And I really, really hope it does. And you seem very confident that it will.
Yeah, I think so. I hope so. And, you know, I'll do everything I can to make sure that it does. So that's all we can really do.
Awful. Okay. Well, thanks, Callum. I'll speak to you another day.
Thanks so much. Good to speak to you, Giles.
Thanks for joining, gents.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.